Our normally scheduled Kim Stanley Robinson science fiction podcast is taking a, we're marooned at the movies, as we like to say sometimes.
That's right. That's right.
With one of our favorite, sort of love to hate him, film directors, Ridley Scott's new Napoleon movie.
Yes. Not science fiction.
No, not really. Jumping right into it. Why are we watching? Why are we talking about this?
Well, I think it was your idea. Ridley Scott?
It
was your idea. Yeah.
Oh.
I feel like you, well, one, we have talked about a lot of Ridley Scott movies. Yeah. And I also feel like you have been developing a kind of Ridley Scott thesis.
Yeah. Well, I did try to watch all of Ridley Scott. I think it was this year. I could look at my list, but I think I've watched most of Ridley Scott's movies this year, or at least in the last 2 years. I'm not sure why. Maybe The House of Gucci kind of got me started on it. But I hadn't seen Gladiator in a really long time. And like a bunch of his movies I just never seen. I'm still not done. I still haven't seen like Black Hawk Down and some of the other ones. But, you know, we watched Alien, and that's like a formative. And we watched Prometheus, and we watched the one after that, Covenant. Are all Ridley Scott's.
Yep. Yep.
And those are kind of formative. Aliens are definitely a formative film, I would say, for kind of, you know, the science fiction genre and body horror and lots of things that we're interested in. We like that movie. And you lecture brilliantly on that movie. You have brilliant thoughts about that film. So I said, why not go ahead and watch a lot of Ridley Scott movies? And, you know, it turns out that the guy just seems to love empire and war a lot in really weird, unexpected ways, right? And so then he's coming out with, you know, Napoleon. You can't get any bigger than that, than you know, the world soul. And, you know, and since, you know, he man who signals a massive shift in world history. And since we're living through another massive shift in world history, might as well take a look at how, you know, one of our filmmakers, I won't even say great filmmakers, prominent, you know, big budget. I mean, big budget filmmakers tackles this topic, and Ridley Scott is one of the only filmmakers who really consistently has turned to the epic form and is the one who can theoretically, you know, pull it off with a few others, you know, in contention. I mean, even if you think about Christopher Nolan, who's the other, one of the other really big blockbuster movie guys, he doesn't really make epic movies. It's got the superhero movies, and he kind of blows up, to put it, you know, no pun intended, you know, figures like Oppenheimer into kind of world historical status.
Yeah.
But it's not like a movie like Napoleon or Kingdom of Heaven or Black Hawk Down or Gladiator, where you're mobilizing hundreds or thousands of men on horseback in the middle of a field and doing all kinds of very meticulous explosions and costumes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I've never seen, what's the Christopher Nolan, Dunkirk? Is that him?
Oh yeah. Dunkirk. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, which might be a point of comparison. And are they both British? I mean, Ridley Scott is, right?
Yeah. Ridley Scott for sure is. And Christopher Nolan is as well. But he's kind of more ambivalently British than Ridley Scott. I'm sure he's British. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, and you, I mean, we should also mention in thinking about why Ridley Scott would be of interest to us. I mean, he also directed Blade Runner.
Right.
Which, you know, between that and Alien, if we ignore Star Wars, mm-hmm. You know, you probably have like the templates for most science fiction movie making, you know, a whole aesthetic world, particularly with Blade Runner, but really with both of those movies, gets kind of put together and mobilized by him. We've never talked about Blade Runner.
No, we haven't done Blade Runner, but yeah, we should do Blade Runner.
We should do it.
I haven't seen it in a long time, and I'm not the biggest Blade Runner fan, but I would feel differently. But Blade Runner, yeah, especially the sci-fi noir and the kind of way you do a Philip K. Dick adaptation.
Yeah, yeah.
That really set, you know, both those movies, Alien and Blade Runner, set the template for a lot of sci-fi that followed in the, you know, following subsequent two or three even decades.
Yeah, yeah.
Setting aside Star Wars, because that's fantasy and like right. That has nothing to do with science fiction at all.
Right, right. And I think that Blade Runner, I'm sure somebody has made this case, and there's probably a case to be made for it's kind of like, you know, aesthetically, like the way that it looks is kind of like techno-orientalism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, yeah. I suspect that of influencing not only other SF films, but also a lot of other, other forms of narrative, science, mm-hmm. science fiction too, you know, like the look of that movie, I think becomes, you know, gets really sort of like seamlessly put together with like whatever we think the look of like cyberpunk is, you know, like, and I think that's one of the things that like I, just, you know, just to be honest, and I don't know whether I can enfold House of Gucci into this or not, but I do think one of the things I like about Ridley Scott is his movies are also pretty, you know, in particular kinds of ways. And I am interested to hear more about what you think about Ridley Scott and Empire. Mm. This movie, I feel like the movie to me that it is the most like is actually probably House of Gucci, which we saw together, but I've only seen once. But partway through this movie, I was like, this just kind of is, it sort of is House of Gucci, but there's like war instead of like corporate battles over like leather goods. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I'll be able to fully articulate my Scott Empire thesis, but also I would just add to the Blade Runner thing, not just science techno noir, but also probably noir in general, science fiction and noir, how it manifested in the, I think it's a huge influence of both genres. But as far as Empire goes, I think, you know, if you think about, I haven't seen Black Hawk Down, but seems to me that with a movie like Gladiator and I'm trying to think of the other ones, but you know, like he's the thinking man's apologist for Empire in kind of post-Soviet, in the post-Soviet moment at the end of history, right? The end of history, as the, like this other podcast, Bunga Cast, talks about, and they're doing a Napoleon episode too, which I think is interesting. But anyway, the kind of apologia of Empire that he does typically tends to rest, in my view, and just taking Gladiator as a prime example, of a soldier. It's a Vietnam syndrome thing. Like the soldier has served faithfully for the purposes of Empire, and then is betrayed by politicians, cast out, returns for revenge, is ultimately justified some one way or another, but that it ultimately apologizes for Empire while at the same time recognizing that it is problematic,
yeah,
in many ways, but also kind of inevitable.
Yeah.
And the inevitability of it is part of the apology of it. Like, sorry, this is just the way it is. So in a way, it's very kind of conservative Western genre style. Like, well, the Indians, they had their day in the sun, but history marches on, and it was a nice way of life, but it's time to fold up the tent and let modernity take its place. And I think Scott is consciously or unconsciously very much a filmmaker who makes movies that make that case. And I think the same could be said for Napoleon too, while yeah. as I'm like articulating that, yeah. right? Like Napoleon in this figure at configuration becomes a transitional figure from, rather than like modernity coming in on horseback, he ushers in modernity, but he's also the classic Western hero of the guy who brings the violence and then must be exiled for exactly that thing. Right. Like right. he can't be part of the order that he institutes. And so it's a kind of mosaic figure as well. You get to the kind of promised land you're not allowed to enter. Or in this case, once you do, you have to end up being expelled, or because you are in this version of Napoleon, you're doomed to repeat yourself. And through the repetition of doing it over and over again, eventually the odds are against you that eventually the gamble will not pay off.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And that kind of helps me think about some things about the movie. And I am kind of like, so, I mean, I will just say generally that I did not hate this movie, despite its extreme. It's really long.
It's actually only like 2.5 hours, but it feels long. Like I looked at my clock many times.
Yes. Yes. I was sitting next to a friend of mine who I could see her just like literally looking at her phone, and like the look on her face was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think I did not hate the movie. I think it has interesting qualities. I mean, I don't think that I would say in any way that I think it's like a good movie. And I don't know how much, I think it doesn't have a ton of control over the things that are interesting about it. And in some ways it might be really exactly as you're saying, like it might be relatively straightforward to think about what's happening in it sort of like ideology wise. I thought a lot, and I will say that the part of it that I enjoyed the most were the battle sequences, which I think are interesting in some ways that actually some of our old conversations made me think about. But the big thing I was thinking while I was watching it is like, so, I mean, I don't know a ton about Napoleon, but like, you know, this is the historical period that like my dissertation work is about, or at least a big chunk of my dissertation work is about this period. And, you know, so, I mean, of course I know the sort of like the British part of it better. But I was thinking, well, this would be a really weird movie to go into and watch if you didn't sort of, I don't know what it would be like to watch it without knowing like what the, you know, like when the, you know, when we get to like the, when we get to Austerlitz and like it says, you know, Austerlitz on the screen, like what's it like if you don't know what happened at Austerlitz? Is it, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it would just be surprised. It would be surprising. I don't know. But the whole kind of like, it's weird. I think, I mean, you know, I really like this is not really a biopic, but it is kind of a biopic, which is a form that I just generally dislike a great deal. But the kind of mix of like, this is a movie that is a sequence of epic events. Mm-hmm. And this is a movie that is supposedly about an individual. Mm-hmm. And this is a movie that's kind of like, oh, here's a great man, but also we're going to show you something real about the great man, which is just primarily his relationship with Josephine, which is, I mean, a whole that obviously we'll have to get to. You know, all of those things I think sit together in a really weird way in the movie. And one thing that we think is like, it's just full, you know, at the level of sort of like thinking about Empire. And I think that idea that this in part does seem to be about the suggestion that like there must be a violent man, you know. The way in which the movie like moves you back and forth between like Napoleon the general and Napoleon the politician, and kind of wanting to, you know, like it needs to show you political events, right? Because that is actually a big part of the story of Napoleon, but it kind of wants to refuse them being political. And mm-hmm. therefore there's like a lot of, I think, there's a lot of kind of confusing stuff in it, like, you know, why we get like the names, we get names on the screen for certain characters and not other characters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We don't really have any explanation for who they are.
Yeah.
You know, like certain things are obviously supposed to be like a little ding, 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 ding. Like, you know, they, you know, as soon as we get like, you know, as soon as we see Robespierre, he's saying the word terror. I mean, obviously, right. Like, you know, but there's a real kind of, there's something in that that I think makes the story actually, you can follow the story because you're like, and then Napoleon does another thing. But there are some things that are quite confusing about it. Like when he returns and, oh, look, there's a king again in France. And like, we have not heard anything about how that's happening, you know, like,
yeah. So, the, yeah.
So, yeah. So I think, so there's something that is a little like interesting to me about like just the very unease of the mix of those things and the way in which the piece that kind of, maybe this is wrong, but I'm just going to say like, maybe the piece that feels like the most gestural is really sort of like the political aspect of it. And like, mm-hmm. there are all kinds of things that we hear nothing about that you might well think we would hear something about. I mean, for one, the Louisiana Purchase. Right. and two, the Haitian Revolution. I thought that might have popped up, you know, but nothing. None of that. And also, but then also oddly, we really are not given a sense in any way of like how it is that Europe gets remade in the Napoleonic period.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the sort of like the shifting sands of empire actually are really like not, I mean, they just, it doesn't really appear like, you know, it's as if we're being shown all of the big battles of Napoleon's career, but actually like even battles wise, we're really not even like, there's no moment where we get like a little title that says, and then he did blah, 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 or, you know,
Like, so we get the titles of the battles, which is the titles of the places, but it would help to have like a map.
Yeah.
Like where was this and why? Why did this battle take place? And then, like the imperial, the political, the politics of empire, but also the ideology of empire. Like, why did people follow this guy to their certain death? And then when he killed them, when he got them all killed, do it again.
Right.
Like right. What is going on there? What is at the heart of the French Revolution? What is?
Oh, well, that we clearly are not supposed to have any thoughts about that. Other than it was a mob, they killed the lady whose hair was really messy when they killed her, and then they squabbled.
Yeah, yeah, and they didn't even squabble. It was just the political leaders.
Yeah, exactly.
Squabbled. Yeah. The people are not in this movie at all.
No.
The displacement of the political. I mean, so yeah, we have this just these battles, which are skillfully done and fascinating. And like, if you don't know anything about it, like I did a report on Napoleon, I think in like the fourth grade or something like that. I'll admit I don't really remember what I said about it or what I wrote about it. But if you don't know anything about it, it's like that's cool. Some cool battles and wow, he was a really skilled general and stuff like that. Although Austerlitz, again, it's like, do they not know there's a fucking lake right there? Like what?
I actually went and because I thought that scene, I mean that, or that sequence
from the trailer too. So if you go in not knowing anything about Austerlitz, as soon as you see that scene, you know that they're going to blow up the ice.
Oh,
if you've seen the trailer.
I don't know if I think I did see the trailer, but obviously I didn't pay attention to it.
Yeah. Anyway,
I thought that sequence was like great. You know, partly because that is the moment in which we're like, oh, this is about like an extreme form of violence.
Yeah.
But also interesting, I went back and I was like, I know that there like was a lake and there's something about like fog in the Austerlitz battle and then the fog clears and then like, but it's already too late because the French are already there or whatever. One of the things that's interesting about that scene, this is what made me think of like a thing that you talked about when we were talking about the Mars books, which is sort of like, you know, like perspective and like miniaturization. Mm. Like part of what's interesting about that scene is if like if we are supposed to be thinking, is that like, I think it is there to say like, one, this is extraordinarily, the extraordinary violence of it. I mean, it's horrifying. Many, so, so much horse death in this movie. Mm-hmm. From the very, our first, like the first exploit we see of Napoleon's, like, but then because of how it's like framed, it makes it seem like that battle was actually like very contained, right? Mm. But actually, I think that like only one, it's only like one front in that battle where they like blew up ice on a pond and like people, Russians and their horses and cannons or whatever all fell in. I mean, it was like, I think, I don't know, but I think what's supposed to make it like militarily, you know, like significant is that it was, is actually like very complicated, but we see it in this interesting, like, as if it were like kind of like two ridges, a lake, and you know, so it's like very condensed for us. And that I kind of like, there's something that's sort of interesting about that. I mean, I, you know, like why that happens. Yeah, I get, you know, you do it that way because that makes it dramatic, because that makes it filmable, all of these other things. You know, it's not that I really think that it, you know, it's not like I'm saying, oh, you could, it should have made it more like the battle really was. What's right. interesting is to think like, what does that, because this is, as you were saying, like there is something about this movie and like what Ridley Scott does, it's about epic and large scale and all of those things, right? And yet we get it like, you know, almost as if we're, almost as if it's like an extremely violent scene of miniatures, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also it positions, because it, because by doing, by putting it that way, it positions Napoleon as this great puppet, not quite a puppet master, but you know, he's in a position of observation and kind of control. So he can, he's in a position, he's, you know, he can orchestrate the forces of history, right, in a certain way. He sets the, he sets the agenda. He determines where history will take place, where and how and what the outcome will be. And at the very, very end, when he's talking to the children on the boat, he says, you know, I have a ability to know where to set my cannons, and that's just, I can't teach it. You know, I've never
been wrong about anything.
I've never been wrong. He literally says something like, the biggest, don't fail at success. Something like that. He says, don't fail at greatness. He says, the most difficult thing is accepting the failures of others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like classic shit, which I'm going to, which I hope we get back to, but it sets him up as this guy who is, can somehow, you know, pulls the strings and knows, you know, at least on the battlefield, right? In his personal life, it's completely different. So again, going back to the political, it's totally displaced onto this relationship with Josephine. Yeah. Or not displaced, rather, but like it's either elided or displaced, or that is where politics happens between a man and a woman.
Yeah.
And many of the other political scenes that have directly to do with politics, he has advisors who are telling him what to do, and then he either like fucks it up or almost fucks it up. Like he's at one point, he's being rehearsed as to like what, or maybe he's dictating a letter or something like that, but he's kind of being told what to say to the ambassador or the czar of Russia and the king of England, like, you know, the exact wording. It, you know, his brother is constantly sort of telling him, you know, what to do. Certain moments he's just completely impetuous and he rushes in and he needs all the guards and the guns to be pointed at the other politicians so that they vote the right way. So he's not competent. I mean, the film presents him again as like not really competent politically. And coming from Ridley Scott's Britishness too, I think like one of the things that at the very end, when the Duke of Wellington is leading this board meeting about like, we have to take this guy out, he says, you know, we've put up with him for long enough, his X, his Y, and his lack of simple good manners. That this is, and from our perspective, on one hand, we're supposed to look at this and say, yeah, but Napoleon, he's so cool, he doesn't follow your rules or whatever. But keeping in mind Ridley Scott's Britishness, and I think there is a critique of, if not empire, of at least Napoleon here, we are supposed to say like, yeah, this guy was rude and we don't like that.
Right, right. Well, there is a whole, I think, yeah. So the British, I mean, the Duke of Wellington, is it Rupert Everett who's playing?
Is that Rupert Everett? No way. Really?
Oh.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, look it up.
It could have been. I just didn't recognize him. He's so old.
He got old, man. So
it is him. Holy shit.
I thought it was Rupert Everett. Right. So that to me was a real like, so there's a whole thing about like, how are we supposed to think about Napoleon? And I think that it is like, I think a version that we get of Napoleon in many versions of the Napoleon story is that he is this kind of like crude, mm-hmm. you know, rough, crude
Corsican,
outsider, right?
Right.
I mean, although like he was also like, you know, an aristocrat too. But in any case, so I think so the Duke of Wellington like really fascinated me because I think this is a place where I think the movie is actually sort of very wobbly in like what it is that it thinks. Cause I think we are supposed to see the British as sort of prissy and uptight. And the idea of the Duke of Wellington, I mean, maybe he actually said this at some point, just being like, oh, he has bad manners. Like, you know, people in Britain had been like living in starvation conditions because of the blockade. I mean, one of the problems with making this movie without like showing the naval part of it is you actually can't understand mm-hmm. like what the stakes are.
Why they were doing, yeah.
And the stakes were, I mean, in part like, you know, the stopping of like flows of capital, but they were also about like, you know, food not getting around too, right? I mean, it was like a miserable period for mm-hmm. like, you know, regular human beings, in which like a whole lot is going on, you know, like mm-hmm. so much that's just like absent from the world of this movie. But so I think that there's a way in which we're sort of supposed to see the British as kind of like prissy and uptight, but then, you know, the weird like the Waterloo sequence, I thought, okay, we're also supposed to, this is just like, oh, we're supposed to be thinking about World War One here, you know, because they're like digging trenches, mm-hmm. like there's the sense of like the muddy battlefield, you know, that's the mm-hmm. French, I think we see digging the trenches. Mm-hmm. And then like, you know, Wellington's strategy as it's depicted in the movie is to be like, no, we must be patient. We must be patient, men. And then we have like the very hilarious, like sort of, you know, seeing the British infantry form themselves, make those like battle formations on the ground, which are basically like
quadrilles or something like that.
I don't know what you call those, where
phalanges?
Like,
no, they're not phalanges, are they? Whatever.
I don't know what they are, but it is like I would think it's like a Roman thing, but I don't know, you know, like, and yet then we see that be effective. Like there's all of this, like, I think confusion about like how attached we're supposed to be to, and clearly like we're supposed to think Napoleon was like, you know, a great war strategist, right? But then we're also supposed to see him as just this like driving id or whatever, which is, you know, and then the Duke of Wellington is like, you know, played by like a class, like the most classic, like British, right. Prissy-faced, yeah. Handsome prissy-faced actor.
Yeah.
And I thought that the scene on the boat, which is, by the way, a very bizarre looking scene, like the background, because I think it's supposed to be that, because the, you know, like the walls are like angled, right? Because it's a ship.
Because it's the stern.
But it really looks very fucked up. Something about the way mm-hmm. they did it like looks extremely strange. Anyway, but that scene, I think we have this sort of like comedic, like undermining, you know, Napoleon is undermining like all of that British good taste because he's the one that the little midshipman, tiny little boys like think is cool. And the Duke of Wellington is just like, you know, grandpa or whatever, who doesn't want you to have a good time. But I felt like that was like very confused, you know, like it couldn't quite get itself to the place. I mean, maybe I think that there's, I agree with you. I think there's a sort of hint that like, oh, the British are the good guys, you know, but like it couldn't totally get itself there. Which maybe has something to do with like the way in which, just like the way in which Joaquin Phoenix plays Napoleon. Like
part of what I think is interesting about the movie. I mean, like, so the lack of kind of context for any of this.
Yeah,
stuff,
yeah, yeah.
I think is really interesting and important to think about. And contributes to how we perceive the British coming in when they do to kind of put down this mad dog finally. Because there's, again, no sense of why the people would be following Napoleon time after time, particularly after Russia, right? After 1812.
Right.
And that he loses 400, you know, after the exile of losing over 400,000 men in the winter, that there's a kind of, I guess you want to say, although this the film doesn't suggest this, but that the people themselves are driven mad by this force and the British are coming in to save them from themselves in a way.
Right, right.
And maybe that's even mirrored by the circling the wagons strategy at Waterloo, while the savage French come in with their horses and just ride circles around them, shooting into them, much like you would see in a Western.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a parallel that's accurate or not, but yeah, the Wellington strategy just seems to be wait for the Prussians to arrive and then overwhelm them with numerical superiority. Because also Napoleon in that scene is just kind of, as much as he was an observer at Austerlitz, but a puppeteer. Here he's much more of an observer, or he's going through the motions. Okay, you know, shoot the artillery. Okay, we did that for a few minutes. Let's send in the infantry. Okay, we did that for a while. That's not going well. Well, we just might as well send in the cavalry as well. And just kind of running down the checklist. And during that scene, Joaquin Phoenix's performance, Napoleon in that is kind of, he's a little bit robotic. He's kind of, there's a sense that he recognizes that it's not working out.
Right.
And that he is again compelled maybe by the forces of history again, history on horseback, like let's get on the horse and go into there and see what happens. And so I think, I think the history on horseback metaphor needs to be taken a lot more seriously in interpreting this film, because there is a great deal of sense that from my perspective, and this gets back to the personal life, and it would be really interesting to see, take a stopwatch and say how much was battle and how much is him with Josephine. It's almost split down the middle. Probably more with Josephine, frankly, but that Napoleon, what's interesting about this portrayal is that rather than have a Napoleon complex, it's clear that he's got an Oedipal complex.
The whole
film, very beginning, when his horse gets blasted with the cannonball, he goes, reaches into the horse's body, reaches out, takes the cannonball, gives it to his brother and says, give this to our mother as a token of, you know, give this to our mother to prove that, you know, I'm going to live up to her expectations or whatever.
Yeah.
And he refers to his mother many times. His mother finally shows up, and then, you know, Josephine shows up, and there are these parallel moments of mother lover thing, and his whole necessity of an heir is intimately tied in with the politics, and his mother takes a major role in all of that. And then, and so this is all just the interpretation is that, and even at the very beginning, again, like right towards the beginning, the survivor's ball after Josephine is released from prison, he's wandering around, he's wearing his uniform. She goes, what kind of costume is that? He goes, this is my uniform. I led the battle at Toulon. He's a little boy, you know, he's a child throughout the whole film, at least when it comes to Josephine, but he's a child playing with toys. And either, you know, that's his position as the puppeteer of history, as the master of history, that, that in miniature, again, he's playing with his soldiers. He's in the position of a kind of child playing with toys, is how powerful this grown man was, or that he just finds himself in a position where he happens to be at the right place at the right time to mold history. Right. So there's a, it's either a matter of play. It's a matter of play or chance.
Right.
Like he happens to be there. And so this other recurring acting motif that Joaquin Phoenix uses is this laughter, this giggle, this tittering. And it often happens when he's, you know, he's being promoted, or he's being told, or he's being told that he's going into exile.
Yeah.
And this laughter is kind of signifies to me, okay, I'm just here for the ride.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
I can't. Okay. You're telling me this is going to happen now. Okay. Whatever. What's next. Right. And so there's this really weird tension about around his agency, about what's actually going on, and if he's just sort of riding the crest of history. But that, and repeatedly he is kind of, you know, when he's approached by Josephine's son, her son plays on, you know, my mother sent me to get my father's sword. You know, playing on that at the very, very end, he's speaking to two little girls who are playing with swords. At the very, right before that ending, in the back of the boat, he's talking to children about what it is to be a great man. So there's this kind of childishness. And to me, that was an interesting take from Ridley Scott, especially in consideration of what I said before about Empire. Does it kind of signal a kind of late turn toward a critique of Empire and war as a very childish kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
It's not something that should be praised. It's not a worthy endeavor. It's actually kind of deeply rooted in a kind of childish pain of, you know, Oedipal conflict, of rejection, of, you know, wanting to do good. The only problem with that reading is that we get none of that otherwise from Joaquin Phoenix's performance. There's no real tension with the mother necessarily. He should have been crazier if that was more a part of it. I mean, the other manifestation of it is the weird humping scenes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The disturbing mating rituals that Napoleon has.
Yeah.
But we could get into that later.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's really, I think that's interesting. I think and that helps us then. I mean, that is another way in which the movie gets like really sort of trapped inside this. I think it does kind of want to be critical of him as like both childlike and childish, you know. Which of course, you know, the real problem with that is that then if you're not willing to show like how it is that like things are happening, but you want to say that he doesn't really have responsibility for them because he's like a kind of, you know, this like very weird baby man, you know, you've created a little like gap there.
Well, again, you know, why do the other characters go along with him?
Right.
What is it about? Again, that's the ideology question of not only why do the people follow him into war, but why do the other politicians let him get away with these things
until
they don't? Right.
Right. Exactly. And we're supposed to think it's because he has the army on his side, but that doesn't, I mean, and this is part of why, like, I don't think it's clear in the movie, like, how much of Europe was under the control of France, you know, like, I think you can't really tell that exactly. Which does also make his power seem different. You know, it seems like it's much more like this kind of like, it's like a French thing basically with that weird, that extremely weird sequence in Egypt, standing in for something
so weird
else, you know? But yeah, I think the so I was thinking it is kind of is there, I mean, like, while I was watching the movie, I was thinking, like, well, is this like the same movie to some extent, like, as the Joker? I mean, is it actually like, because I mean, like, I mean, I know Joaquin Phoenix tends to do the same set of things, but this characterization felt like really not kind of unlike the Joker. I mean, not just the laugh, but like the kind of like, I'm a little bit of a madman who might fly off the handle at any moment part of things. I mean, there's nowhere to go with that, but like, yeah. And then the like the relationship with Josephine is so it's really hard to know what we're supposed to make of it because part of me thinks because I don't think we are exactly supposed to be. I mean, I think we're supposed to maybe disapprove of how obsessive he is about her and, you know, his controlling nature. But then when we see her go into exile after the divorce, when she moves to Malmaison, like, we have no explanation for why she wouldn't have just like continued to live her life. Because clearly, you know, even if she didn't feel like she could go to Paris and meet up with all the handsome young, you know, like gents, like they would definitely come to her house, you know? Like, I mean, so, and yet we see her just like twice standing by what looks like a just like very depressing, like kind of golf course yard with a pond in it, wearing a very tacky looking lavender cloak. They're
It's
too
never
seen of her out there in the rain,
lavender
right?
cloak. It's never not March where she
Yeah,
is, just like
exactly.
cold and damp.
And I think and then that's also interesting because she is supposed to, I think, carry for us some set of claims about how we're supposed to think about the modernity, if this is the birth of the modern world, which is obviously like a dumb, that is a dumb thing to think. But I think the movie is a little bit like about that. Like, okay, so we know really nothing about the French Revolution except for all of the cliches. And we get a few little titles at the beginning, which is basically like the mob kills the king, and then it kills Marie Antoinette. And we get to see them kill Marie Antoinette. And then, like, you know, we see, you know, I think Josephine is marked out for us as modern because we have a very sort of familiar version of like the emergence of a kind of modernity in decadence, right? So at the ball, you know, this sort of decadent repetition of an aristocratic life. All, and we've already completely lost, we've lost, you know, like we've lost the thread of what's going on with the revolution. None of that has
No,
mattered to us, in
it's
fact,
just
at all.
no, it one king has been replaced with another king where you just don't call him king anymore.
Right,
Like it's still
exactly.
everyone's still living in luxury and you
It's the
know.
same. The only sign of things being different is that her hair is shorn, right? I mean, we haven't seen her with long hair at that point, but that her hair is cut quite short and she's not wearing a wig, right? You know, I mean, and that like, I mean, maybe you guess that like wigs are out of fashion, but one thing that you might think for sure is that like that is a haircut that like you would not expect on a woman in the year 1792 or whatever year that's supposed to be, 17. And also, just to, you know, point back to Blade Runner for a minute, she's also wearing like a ribbon choker around her neck. I mean, and I will say, like, I thought her costumes, except for that lavender cloak, which I did not get at all, which looked very cheap. Otherwise, her costumes are incredible. They're really, really very beautiful. And I really liked her. I thought she was like great in what was probably a basically thankless role. She manages to give you that feeling that there's like a lot going on, even though in fact, like she actually, it's almost nothing to do.
All she has to do is kind of hypnotize him to say certain words or like, you're nothing without me. And he's like, you're right. You see right through me. I'm just a mama's boy.
Exactly. But she, so that first time we see her, that haircut and the choker around her neck, I think if you took a little look back to Blade Runner and you look at what Pris, the android played by Daryl Hannah, one, same haircut. Yes, she's blonde, but same haircut, same choker also, I believe. Uh-huh. Although maybe it's the Sean Young character who wears the choker in Blade Runner. But in any case, like it, she, and she has the like, you know, she has like a very long neck, I feel like, okay, there are a lot of directors who are men who have a certain like lady type that they just like use over and over again without seeming to be aware of it. But it is a little like, there is a little like spookiness to that image of her, you know, there. She does seem like a slightly uncanny figure, you know, she seems modern in the way that we use that word to just mean to mean like contemporary. And he seems like a weird, like in that scene, like very much like a little, little boy. Also, his age was very confusing to me. I don't know how old Joaquin Phoenix is, but I both felt like in a lot of the movie, he looks too old to be Napoleon at that time. Sure. But he also seems to me to look a lot older than I think Joaquin Phoenix should look.
Yeah, he's 49. He's 49.
I guess Napoleon ages you. Anyway, all I'm saying is I think we're supposed to have this little bit of an idea of there being something like quite modern about their marriage.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Well, she's got kids from a previous marriage.
She has kids from a previous marriage. She's like basically like, you know, okay, I gotta get together with this unappealing guy because, you know, how am I gonna? Well, it doesn't seem like the issue is feed her kids because they conveniently disappear for almost the entire
whole movie. No, she's a liberated woman. She takes a lover. She, you know, I've been to prison. You know what that means about me. been around. That doesn't bother you, right? Like, you know, that kind of thing.
I've been to prison. So
scandal, you know, like the scandalized, you know, there are new rules about marriage and like who can marry whom and like what that means and that kind of thing. And then how you can behave in public, I don't know, around, you know, your lovers or something like that. Even though, they still are going to have like footmen in every room waiting on the man in foot, but then they're just going to, you know, fuck in front of them or something. And it's like, okay, I'm sure that the aristocrats have never done that before in the history of the world until modernity, until Napoleon invented it. But yeah, she, her role is, I mean, what's interesting about her role, one of the interesting things, other than it's kind of, thanklessness and just, I mean, the obsession he has with controlling her is also like, hey, we got married. Like, what's the deal here? Like, why are you with this other guy while I'm in Egypt or something? But the fact that he continues writing letters to her even after she's dead.
Yeah.
And the very end, like the last words being, whether he's imagining this letter or that it's a real letter from her, come to me, Napoleon. Let's try this again. Mm-hmm. You know, the repetition of it makes me, you know, again, wonder about the timing of this film. You know, is Napoleon, you know, like, you know, a film, all these films do this, all epic films, all films about war, that one of their primary functions is to get us ready for the next war, especially in America.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's do this again. Let's try to conquer the world. So who's the audience for that and who's the messenger of it? And who is Napoleon in this configuration? Is it Putin? Is it Biden?
Right.
Is it Elon Musk? Right. I think there's a little bit of the, you know, the boyish weirdness is Elon Musk-y, you know, like the kind of spectrum-y kind of behavior of Napoleon in this movie.
I guess that's also true.
The child worship, like the worship of children on him, and the don't fail at success mantra right. that he gives them is a very Muskian, adds a very Muskian flavor to it. But then again, like the big problem that we can identify is where do women fit into this calculus here? They're just there to kind of cheer you on through threatening to, you know, fuck the Tsar of Russia or right. whatever.
Right. Yes. Yes. I mean, basically, exactly. Like, yeah. I mean, and the sort of like something that I thought was very funny in the movie, and I guess this has, you know, I don't have any conclusions about like what we can do with the whole like Britain France thing, but that like when he's reading the like scandal stories in the newspaper and looking yeah. at the cartoons, they're in English.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he could be reading the British press, which did, I believe, spend a certain amount of time making fun of Napoleon, but why would he be reading a British paper?
I mean, why do they all have British accents? It's the same shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Same shit.
Yeah. It has that feeling of like, it really is different when you're like showing the words on the page, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, this is like, I think the like the other than this is like I'm giving like a psychological picture of this man, of a kind of man or something right. like that, and therefore, you know, his woman as well, or it has like it, I mean the movie has no thoughts about women. I mean, you know, and why the story, I do think there's as much Napoleon and Josephine stuff as there is.
Yeah.
And you have no way to read, like when he gets married to Marie Therese.
Yeah. Her like, one scene.
And you have no way of knowing, like, is she just like extremely well coached? Is she an adept politician to be like, oh, you're so handsome, yes, I'd love to go directly to the bedroom? Or is she actually looking at him and like, oh yeah, you're a really huge fucking hero, and I'm like yeah. psyched that like yeah. of all of the, you know, dolts I could have been married to, like at least I got to get married to like the like exciting one or something.
Yeah,
you
she
know,
has
like,
a she has a poster of Napoleon up in her bedroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Above
exactly.
her bed, and she, you know, she's been a big fan for years. And
but we just don't, like, we don't know about any of those things. No. And like when he, like, I mean, it is really weird. This is just like I'm now just like went into a free association quote, but it's really weird that they show them shooting the cannons at the pyramids.
Yeah,
because one of the things about that venture into Egypt that doesn't get mentioned is that one of the things I believe on that, one of the things that definitely happened on that was that there were all of these like French like artists and natural philosophers and like you know, whatever, historians, orientalists of all kinds, who just like made like volumes of material, like wrote and drew all of these pictures, and also they took a whole lot of stuff, I think, mm-hmm. on that particular venture, including I think the Rosetta Stone.
Okay.
So there's like a whole I may be getting that wrong, but I think that might be then, and then the British take it away from them. Uh-huh. I don't know. Who knows, but something like that. But in any case, like part of that venture into Egypt is very much this like exactly like European like natural scientific like method. We're gonna actually like get in there, and we're gonna like measure all of this stuff, and we're gonna like diagram it, and we're gonna figure all of these things out about it. And that, right, which is part of the alibi for empire is right. like, we're better knowers, you know, or you don't know anything, or you don't know how to preserve your monuments, but we're going to know. So it's weird to have it instead to be, and I'm sure that they did like open up tons of sarcophagi and like expose the, you know, expose the bodies inside them so that they ended up crumbling and whatever. I'm sure that they were also like highly destructive, but to characterize that primarily as like this, like, you know, the kind of the sort of like knowledge project that's happening there is the knowledge project is an imperial knowledge project, but instead we see it as like, you know, oh, they were like such, you know, like goons. They're just like, we're shooting their cannons at the pyramids. They were doing something that like really was more insidious probably ultimately than right, just shooting off the cannons.
Well, that scene that just stands, you know, those events, like a handful of events just stand in for a lot of stuff and are meant to do a lot of work that in part is just eliding the stuff that they actually did.
Right, right. And we have no explanation for why. I mean, this is another like geographical problem.
Oh, yeah.
Why would they be in Egypt? Like, it never is explained, you know, like we get references to like, we need to stop the British. But like, unless you understand, like, if you don't have a map in your head of where these, you know, these empires are actually fighting with each other at this moment, it's like, what the fuck are they in Egypt?
There's no geopolitics there at all that would really help to frame all of this and explain it.
No slave trade.
No slave trade.
No Haitian revolution.
Yeah, none of that. What was I going to say? The Egypt sequence is really fascinating, and it does certainly reinforce a lot of my observations about Ridley Scott's attitude toward, let us say, Arab people or non-European people, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know, you know, there's a line in the narration about why they're there, but
right,
it goes so fast, and it basically is spoken over the image of, you know, hundreds of Egyptian troops or British troops in Egypt, whatever it is, who are lined up in front of the pyramids with, you know, one leader on horseback in front of them. They shoot a cannon at the pyramid and it explodes. And then the leader falls off his horse. And that's basically the victory in the battle.
Yeah.
You know, that they, that the French come in with their technological Western superiority, and literally the heathens just bow down in front of their god cannon, right? Yeah. Their thunder stick. And it's just taken, it's a bloodless battle where they just acknowledge you come from a superior civilization than we do, and it's not even worth fighting. There's not a battle scene.
Right.
There's not a battle scene there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that they shot the nose off the Sphinx. I thought that was what they did.
I don't know.
Maybe that's also an urban legend. I mean, like Ridley Scott in one of the interviews, I think that he says, you know, did Napoleon shoot cannons at the pyramids? I don't know, but it seems like something he would do. I mean, that's kind of what he says in it. Like, I don't care. It looks cool is kind of his alibi.
Right,
for it.
Right.
So that's a whole other manifestation of empire, right?
Right.
Like that's 230 years after, 230 years of empire building on itself, of Orientalism building on itself over and over, these just layers of that kind of attitude that we finally get to, like, hey, did history happen? Who knows?
Who knows, right? Yeah, exactly.
So there's the kind of like essentialization of these, you know, Egyptian heathen savages or whatever. But then like opening up the sarcophagus, which stands in for all of this, you know, and in the best reading, the most charitable reading, stands in for everything that you're talking about of the scientists and the natural historians and the, you know, proto-archaeologists coming in and doing this work. What we get is Napoleon opening a sarcophagus, exposing the mummy inside.
Cute.
Reaching out his hand to touch the mummy, and the mummy withdrawing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the visual pun is almost, I don't know if it's funny or not. I don't know if it's enraging or not. I don't even know if it's intentional, although it couldn't not be.
It's gotta be
intentional. It is so egregious.
Yeah.
It is so egregious.
Yes. On top of which, I think that is one of the very few sequences in which we get the, oh, Napoleon is short because he's having to stand on something.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
it's the only time when we see Josephine cheating on him.
Oh.
The only time. He's writing letters back to her.
It's when
his second in command says, I'm going to tell you something that's going to make you upset.
Right.
And he says, your wife's cheating on you. And he's like, you have to go. You don't get dessert.
Right.
He dismisses him from the dinner table. You don't get dessert.
Yeah.
That is like astonishing sequence of like events there that just, you know, yeah.
That, I mean, that's the kind of thing that makes, I mean, and also that it has this oddly, I was just thought like when the mummy tips over, it has like a Three Stooges quality. If he had like fallen off the thing he was standing on, which I think he like mimes a little bit that he's kind of like tottering there.
Yeah.
Like, that was a part where that made me feel like, is this movie actually just like House of Gucci? Is it, you know, it's just like a continuation of that movie?
There are some laugh lines in here. I mean, that was a funny, there's some funny lines that completely, I don't know if they're intentional, but they completely deflate, you know, the destiny has brought me this lamb chop. That's clearly a laugh line.
Right, right.
That's clearly a joke, but it probably goes over a lot of the, I don't know if it goes over the audience's head or not, but the when we see Louis XVIII, who again doesn't get a caption, but his wig is the same as his dog.
Yeah. Yes.
Like he's wearing the same hair as his dog is wearing. Yeah. Anyway, but that mummy scene is also another one of these, like, okay, come on. Like even the mummy won't return his affections.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 No, I think that's a good reading of it. And it is like a way in which this movie is like, just like the incoherence of it, you know. I also wanted to say that this is my other big connection to House of Gucci, is that like that movie had a lot of dogs in it, and you know, like, and in a lot of scenes, there are a lot of scenes where like some like high drama, you know, screechy argument is going on, and then there are just like some dogs in the background that are just kind of wandering around. They're not like, they're not acting.
Yeah.
They're just like, you know, trying to get out the door, running. And some same thing in this movie, like many scenes when there are like, they're the scenes where people are holding dogs.
Yeah.
Which is big compliment to the Pomeranian that Josephine is holding, that is like kicking her violently while she's trying to carry it around. But there are also large dogs that are just like, in the corners, only occasionally does anyone pay attention to them. And it's this strange, like, kind of, I was thinking, like, it produces this weird sort of naturalism, which is not, like, Ridley Scott's mode at all. But, you know, like, then oddly sort of, like, at the margins, sort of, like, on the edges of the frame, there are these beings who are just like acting like in a very natural way and who kind of like can go in and out of the frame, which like extends the feeling of what we're looking at from these, like, you know, tableau kind of sequences. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, maybe he just really likes dogs and he's old enough now that he, you know, is just like, let's put some dogs in the scene.
Have some dogs. There's one, there's one other scene where Napoleon comes home. I can't remember when it actually is, but then it's toward the end. It's in the second half of the film where he's like teaching the dog a trick and playing with the dog, and Josephine is laughing and giggling. It's meant to be like a kind of one last moment of domestic bliss before they have to get a divorce because she can't have kids.
Right. Right.
But that, you know, and yeah, in light of that, you just have to question whether whatever, like whether that was in the script or whether Ridley Scott was like, hey, play with that dog and like just be a clown for Vanessa Kirby for a minute and we'll get some, like, you know, B-roll of domestic happiness or whatever.
Right, right. Yeah.
I as far as the beauty of the film, like it was so dark. I know this is a common complaint with like digital cinema and like recent movies and stuff, but I mean, there's a whole other thing but to say about this idea that there's like, you know, no or minimal CGI or whatever, like there's tons of CGI in this movie. Like it's very obvious how much CGI there was, but like just the claim, you know, that this is produced by Apple Studios and probably within the next few years, there's only going to be like Apple Studios, Netflix might not even exist. We'll have like three studios, you know, and they're all be using digital cameras. I just found, especially that Toulon sequence, which takes place at night. Okay, to be fair.
Yeah.
But a lot of it takes place indoors by candlelight. And I'm like, God, the lighting in Barry Lyndon was better and more clear.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just so dark. You couldn't really make out sort of anything. And that, you know, I don't know. I'd have to talk to my technical film studies friends if that's still being used as a kind of the darkness just as an alibi to like hide laziness or just save on lighting, labor and set design or something, or if I'm just missing something, or if the bulb in my projector was just at the projector in the movie theater was just bad and old, which is also very, very likely because they don't get replaced nearly as much as they should. But just not being able to make things out.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I do feel like this is like, and just the kind of, I mean, this is probably not technically true, but just a feeling that I have about like, around the edges of, you know, most movies now, there is just a kind of faint pixelization, a blur. A general kind of like shittiness that is not
Well, I don't know, how did it compare, just we can wrap up but Killers of the Flower Moon, I think you also saw that.
I did not see Killers of the Flower Moon. No.
Well, you know, as far as length goes, Killers of the Flower Moon is significantly longer.
It's like another hour longer. Yeah.
Yeah. And it didn't feel that way. You know, I guess I looked at my clock a few times with Killers of the Flower Moon, but not with the urgency that I looked at my clock with this. I mean, not that, again, I enjoyed it. I had a good time. The battle scenes were cool.
Yeah.
And it gave me a lot to think about, but I don't know what a good movie is anymore anyway. I mean, I don't know. I just find movies either interesting or uninteresting. And usually I find them interesting because they're bad or interesting because they're good. But like,
yeah.
You know, it's a movie. You could spend your time any number of ways. You might as well go see this one unless you want to bake a pie or go on a long walk.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think I probably still will see Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that I saw this in a movie theater. I think if I had watched it as I watch most movies, which is on my laptop.
Yeah.
I would have just turned it off.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe also like that would have been fine too. I guess just proving your point that like I really don't know. I mean, I do like, I'm definitely like, I mean you have to see Black Hawk Down.
Yeah,
because I do think that is a movie. I haven't seen it since it came out, but I think my memory of it, or that's not true, my memory of what I thought about it, which is maybe not a memory of it, but my memory of what I thought about it is that it's a very racist movie.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly. And so I think it actually probably plays really pretty well with the way that you're thinking about, like, you know, Ridley Scott and his imperial ambitions. And, you know, yeah, I found this movie, like, I felt like I was interested in it, but in, like, a decidedly idle way, which is maybe just because, like, this is a moment in which it's... whatever like the fantasy was that it might be important to like understand how cultural productions work, it now feels mostly like, I mean, we know how they work, you know.
I think part of I think part of the fascination, my fascination with my interest in the movie, I'm not fascinated by the movie. I'm just, my interest in interpreting the movie is in its incoherence and
its
inability to give an account of the present, and where we sit within, between history and the future in a way. And like whether Napoleon is Putin or Biden or Zelensky or Xi or whoever he's supposed to be, like, and what all this means and where we're at. I think it's like reliance on clear Oedipal, you know, clearly Oedipal storyline is sort of indicative also of just its, not its lack of ideas, but it's just rehashing. I mean, again, like the very last line is, let's try this again.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, could we try something new? I mean, like, there, is there no new thing out there? Is there nothing new under the sun?
No, there's just empire in the couple form.
Yeah, really. I mean, there truly is. Underscored by the fact, again, that as soon as he has a child, he brings it to Josephine.
Yeah.
As if like, you know, that was so, I was expecting her to throw the kid in the lake.
She's too depressed at that point.
I know.
She can't even work up to being Medea. She just is like, oh, yeah. You know, it's a baby.
Yeah, I mean, so it's like, I'm glad that 80-year-old directors are still getting out there and doing their thing.
Absolutely.
For sure. Because nobody, you know, he can still do it. It's not like it's good, but nobody else really does this anymore, except for unless you're doing a superhero movie.
Right.
And those are somehow even more incoherent than, they have even less.
Right.
Or their ideas about the present and the future are more horrifying than this one.
Right.
At least this one is confused. Right. Those are like very clear where we're going, which is not something you want to imagine. I don't know. I don't have answers. I'm hoping that Michael Mann's Ferrari in a few weeks will give them to me.
I mean, you know, it's Michael Mann. So, but like, why? What? I mean, that was the other reason that House of Gucci was on my mind, because I was like, oh, so now Michael Mann is going to make House of Gucci, but it's going to be cars instead?
Yeah.
And this is just like what Adam Driver does.
Just what Adam Driver does.
It's secretly Italian.
Isn't that so weird? Adam Driver.
I don't get it.
Weird.
I don't get it. You made movies starring William Peterson. Well, yeah. Okay. Maybe I'm not making my case there, but you know.
Pacino, De Niro, Colin Farrell.
I know that there are people who like Adam Driver. I don't get it.
Anyway, I'll let you go.
Matt. Oh, I was going to say, you know what? You remember how we did an episode not that long ago? 2 weeks ago, maybe?
About that other thing that we talked about?
About nothing. We just like...
Oh, the check-in about. Episode.
Our check-in
episode?
That's
why I couldn't remember why.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I have heard from many people compliments about that episode.
Wow.
People were like, that was really interesting. It was really great to hear you guys talk about, you know.
Talk about nothing?
I mean, that's what my feeling was that we had done. But including from some like very smart former students of mine who were like, oh, I just happened to see that you have podcast and listen to this episode. And I thought like, oh dear.
Yeah, I really hope my students don't find out that I have a podcast or listen to that last episode, because I was complaining about not the ones who would actually listen. I wasn't complaining about you. I was complaining about the state of American education and academia, which you are a victim.
Yes.
Not your fault.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, and also I was just going to say, I had some very nice conversations last week with people who found me via the podcast, and that was really lovely.
That's right. Yes.
That was really a nice thing, and I really appreciate those folks for reaching out. It was very fun.
Shout out, and maybe one day I'll talk to you as well.
Absolutely. The reclusive Matt Housky.
Can't ever, you know, pin me down. So hard. So difficult.
Man of mystery.
Okay. Well, we'll be back another time. I think, yeah, we should stop and then, yeah. And then, yeah, thank you for listening and we'll see you next time. Happy New Year. If we don't see you.
Yeah. Solstice, happy solstice. This
will free be Palestine solstice. Again, but
free Palestine,
you know,
happy
no
solstice.
Chance of that happening. Yeah.
No, stay strong.
Stay strong.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.